Well, joining us now for our monthly segment that we call Signals and Noise from the Communication Faculty at Southern Oregon University, Andrew Gay is with us, as well as Chris Lucas, an instructor there. And it's been kind of fascinating. It always is, it seems like, in the Twitterverse anyway. And I was going to ask you specifically, I've tried to read this and understand it, and it's not easy. The whole thing, the story in the Daily Beast about the Nicole gal who was, was she a bot? And then we found out she wasn't a bot. And what is a bot and all of that? I wonder if you have some feelings on that particular story, because Donald Trump tweeted last weekend thanking her. And of course, that sent everybody on the internet looking to try to find out more information about this story.
Right. So one of the things we're seeing during this kind of news cycle, that, you know, political year, is the rise of these bot followers on Twitter, where I don't actually know the figure, but I know that there's been research to show that there's a fairly large percentage of the president's followers on Twitter are bots, which means these are automated followers. So the president retweeted or tweeted a thank you to one of his followers. And the interesting thing about this follower was that her picture was a stock photo, and that most of the users that she followed and interacted with were also people who had stock photos as their profile pic. And so an assumption was made early on that these were all bots. And then reporters went down the rabbit hole. And so there's this great article in the Daily Beast where they actually track down the real Nicole Mincy, more or less.
Right.
because we're still not 100% sure who she is and what her role is in the whole thing. But it's really interesting because, you know, there's this ring of fake accounts that she and a group of friends created. They were all these different personalities that they'd stolen the stock photos. They didn't pay for them. And so all the accounts have been shut down because the stock photo company came after them.
Right.
But yeah, so it was kind of an interesting story about understanding how Twitter works, understanding, you know, what sources can you trust? Who are the people you're interacting with online? It is a brain twister, though. It's kind of hard to understand.
I was wondering, you know, is this something just as simple as trying to sell T-shirts, because that was a component in all of this? Or is there something really deeper and more sinister that we need to worry about with these bots?
Well, you know, there's a kind of a larger credibility crisis, I guess, going on, we might say. I mean, and part of that has to do with the growth of these automated forms of communication. I mean, I don't know if I would say it's sinister necessarily. I think people have a lot of complex motivations, and some of them are commercial. Some of them are political and ideological. I think that just really puts the onus on us to be pretty skeptical, especially on certain platforms where we don't know, right, the provenance of some of these messages. And we tend to think that the little universe that we've built for ourselves in whatever social media we're on, we tend to judge that as highly credible because, well, we built that ourselves. It's mostly our friends. And so we may sort of lower our guard a little bit.
Right.
So I think the challenge is to just stay vigilant, right, and diligent in reading whatever source you're using.
My guests this morning are Andrew Gay and Chris Lucas from the Communication Faculty at Southern Oregon University. If you'd like to join the conversation, have any questions about media and some of the things that have been going on recently, contact the Jefferson Exchange, our toll-free number, 800-838-3760, or you can send us an email, jx@jeffnet.org. I have two or three more topics here, but I wanted to know, is there anything that's really on your mind that you'd like to talk about?
We're just talking out in the lobby about just how much is happening day by day in the world of media and how hard it is even just to stay up on it, you know, and to kind of come in every couple of weeks here and sift through so much that's important in that world.
Right. I mean, we were talking about how, and the last show we did with Precious and I, you know, Anthony Scaramucci wasn't even the thing. You know, we didn't know who that was. And now, you know, a month later, he's not really a thing anymore. But for that period right between, like, that was one of the biggest media stories going on was the Mooch. And
yeah.
And so it's just an interesting environment to be analyzing media.
Yeah, it's like there's been tweets out there and memes about who can serve the shortest amount of time in the Trump administration. So, I mean, it's just something odd that keeps going on all the time. Well, my question that I – another question I had was simply on Netflix. I was reading about up to one-third, I believe, is the number of traffic in the evening in the United States is Netflix alone. And they are trying to employ a model where they produce more and more of their own original programming. I guess licensing fees for existing TV shows and movies is just huge. It's a big, big expense. And obviously, if they own it, there's a long-term potential there. They can keep running those shows forever and monetize them. But they're $20 billion in debt. I don't know in the media world if $20 billion for a company like Netflix, if that's a big deal or not. I mean, is it? Are they spending too much money to own their own stuff?
I mean, that's an interesting question. On the point of the content, right, the news just came out that Disney is pulling out of a deal with them. So, I mean, I know that my kids watch a lot of Disney programming on Netflix. So, yeah, I mean, Netflix has to keep producing new content because it is getting more and more expensive to license the content, but it's expensive to produce content, as we know, too. So, you know, I think the big question is how will they monetize their product and continue to monetize it. We see every time that they raise rates a dollar, they lose a certain number of subscribers. People get angry. Mm-hmm. People rant like, oh, I can't believe I'm paying for this. And then you see that they're $20 billion in debt. So I don't know. Chris, do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, this is really fascinating. I mean, we're beginning to see perhaps a kind of a shakeout in this long-term question of, you know, what is the future of media going to be in terms of delivery? And Netflix, you know, going back, you know, 10 years or so, they were already starting to try to get ahead of this and both getting into licensing deals but also generating content. Everybody's saying, well, why is Netflix starting to make this content? It doesn't look very good. They don't have a lot of money for it. But, you know, clearly they were recognizing, as then, you know, HBO pretty quickly started getting into this as well and sort of doing HBO Go. And now other, you know, what we traditionally thought of as networks are now saying, well, we're going to try to build our own kind of so-called over-the-top system, right, where we're just going to go directly to the customer and try to get subscription fees. So what Disney wants to do, of course, is just create their own mini Netflix, right, and just push out Disney content. And I would fully expect other major studios to start doing the same.
Well, CBS has launched one, and you know, there's a lot of buzz for the new Star Trek TV series, the return of Star Trek to TV, except it's not coming to normal TV. It's coming to CBS All Access, so that's another subscription service you have to get. And so the question, I mean, you know, one of the other topics we've been talking about is the box office right now. Summer box office is down and kind of a bad year for movies right now. And so I think looking across the entertainment industry and the media that's created, we're still not really sure what the new model is because, you know, how many different subscription services are people going to be willing to subscribe to, right? I'm a big Star Trek fan. I still haven't decided whether I'm going to get CBS All Access because that's another subscription service. Am I really willing to do that?
Well, you know, there was always a few years ago, the discussion was that, cable has gotten so expensive, and look at this, I can subscribe to Netflix and get all kinds of stuff, which is true. I mean, there's more stuff on Netflix than I have time to watch. When I watch a movie, it takes me 3 days, usually with my schedule. I mean, I just can't sit down and devote 2 hours, but I love that. I can't do that at the theater, but I can do that at home. But like you say, after a point in time, how many subscription services at $9.95, which doesn't seem like a lot, but they add up, and pretty soon you've got a cable bill again.
Well, right. Exactly. I mean, cable has collapsed, and we're now having an a la carte. We're moving towards an a la carte system where you're going to say, well, these are the things I want to see, but you're only going to be able to pick so many. Right, you're gonna have to decide. I mean, for me, I don't watch a movie over several days. It's just I go on Netflix and I just spend all my time searching, and then I never watch anything.
There's definitely a real question of what the future of the theatrical window is for the movie industry, and you know, this, you know, 2015 to 2016 was actually a bit of an up year. There was a slight rise in box office, but now it's, you know, down something like 12 to 15% this summer. Mm-hmm. Very worrying. The AMC, which is one of the big theatrical chains, saw its stock price coming down quite a bit. So there's
Is this Netflix that's causing this? What's what? Why aren't people going to the movies?
Well, it's the streaming, streaming to the home. I think that the theatrical model has not really done a lot of work in improving its kind of customer experience, right? And, what it costs quite a bit to go to the theater. It's tough for families. The food's expensive. There are some successful chains out there. You think of like McMenamin's, right, up in Portland, or
Alamo.
The Alamo starts in Texas but is now going nationwide. Those are theaters where you can get drinks, you can get food, and it's a whole different kind of experience. You often have other kinds of ancillary experiences built in. So I think if theaters can start moving toward creating a fuller experience – rather than just going and spending a ton of money just to watch this movie, they might have a better future.
Yeah, I think it's a lot of different things. I mean, people were talking about, is it exhaustion with what's being put out there? I mean, we're having, again, another summer of sequels and franchises, some of them pretty critically panned. Yet we have a movie like Wonder Woman that exploded and was an enormous hit. So I don't know. I was talking with a screenwriter friend of mine, and he's been just asking friends of his who, like I, have young children. And he said, I've been talking to these various couples who have young children, and they all say they don't go on dates to the movies anymore. And do you think it's why do you think that is? And we were talking about it, and it used to be, if you got the babysitter and you went to dinner and a movie. Mm-hmm. And for us, because we can watch movies at home, there's been at least three times I can think of that my wife and I went to stand in line to get our ticket, and halfway, right when we were about to buy our ticket, thought, let's just go to get drinks and talk instead, right?
Right.
Because we don't have to go to that movie experience, and it's just easier and cheaper to spend our time in other ways if we can later watch on Redbox or Netflix or something.
The theatrical window is still really important to the larger industry, because this is really where films sort of break out and become part of the larger cultural conversation and become these kind of must-see events. Even if you don't see it in the theater in that first couple of weeks, within a month or two, it is going to be on Amazon or Netflix, and you can get to it.
Although Netflix believes that model is going to go away. I mean, they're making a big bet right now that theatrical is not going to keep living the same way.
Right.
I mean, right now, I'm on the programming committee for the Ashland Independent Film Festival, and Netflix now is kind of making it very difficult for the films they acquire to play at film festivals, because their bet is that we no longer need that theatrical run to get the word out. And, unfortunately, because of the way Netflix works, we can't see their numbers. They kind of tell us whether things are hits or not, but we're just trying to trusting them.
Right.
So we don't really know how that's going. But again, my friend who's a screenwriter, his film premiered at Sundance, got picked up by Netflix, and premiered on Netflix. Never had a theatrical run, The Discovery.
One of the real damages to the film culture, if this comes to pass, is going to be not necessarily the big monster tentpole movies, but it's going to be this mid-range, right, which has already been really suffering. But you have films what's this Girls Trip, right? This film that was really broken out of comedy. Nobody really heard of it, very much until last month. Comes out and it's a fantastic, sort of bright, optimistic, fun comedy, and it's made an enormous amount of money. It's probably going to be one of the most profitable films of the year, but without that theatrical window, there's no way that they would have had sort of the promotional budget, right, to get that in front of a lot of eyeballs.
Yeah, and that's a lesson I think that it will be interesting to see if Hollywood picks up on this. Some of the most surprising hits have been, Girls Night, Get Out, and then Wonder Woman. These films that are now serving the non-white male audience, right?
Looking
at women, looking at people of color, and those films are breaking out and having a huge audience. So is Hollywood going to respond?
I've noticed that Netflix seems to be pretty open-minded about the types of fare that they offer, and maybe in time they'll become a lot more focused. I hope not. I like the fact that you can look at something and pick whatever strange reason you want to watch it. I just watched the series Ozark on Netflix.
One of my pick three.
And it was... I watched it because my family for multiple generations lived in the Missouri Ozarks. So I had a connection, and I thought, were these people, as my parents used to say, oh, it was bad back there. There's a lot of crime. There was a lot. So I watched it, and I And I know it's not an accurate portrayal necessarily, but it was like, yeah, there's a lot of crime in this movie in the Missouri Ozarks. So you see these kind of things that you might not never, you, it would never make it to network TV, or it might not make it to a theatrical release. Mm-hmm. You know, I was talking with my wife, and I don't know if this is a good parallel or not, but if you know what you want to buy, you can go to a big box store and buy it. If you don't know what you want to buy, there's still a model out there for a mom and pop type store that you can go in where their whole thing is service. And you were talking about the theater in Portland that makes it more of a almost service oriented thing. You're not just watching a movie. And I wonder mm-hmm. if that'll be a survival mode for a lot of theaters.
Well, one of the, you know, I guess services we could call it that these streaming platforms provide, or at least Netflix especially, has, you know, they have this algorithm and they are looking at what you watch and what you seem to enjoy, and they're going to start pushing that towards you. And I think this is something we really appreciate. In many ways, you discover things that were parallel or quite similar to what you've liked in the past. At the same time, there's a filtering there, right, that I think is worth thinking carefully about and realizing that actually there is a much deeper archive, much deeper pool of content there that maybe you're not seeing because mm-hmm. Netflix has decided, well, that's not his
that's
bag,
not for you,
right?
Right.
We have a call from Mark in Reading. Go ahead, Mark.
Good morning. Here in Reading, we have a 8-screen theater that shows second-run films, and it's $3 most days, and then on Tuesdays it's $1.50 all day long per show. And if it's a 3D movie, you have to pay an extra $2 to rent the glasses. So that works out for me because I'm a cheapskate. I never go to movies except when they cost as little as possible. And one time a woman tried to give me $3 so I could see the movie on Monday. I said, you got to be kidding. Why would I watch it today when I can see it tomorrow for $1.50? Buy some popcorn. I don't know what you did with the $3. But.
Well, thanks, Mark. You know, that's a good point because as I think about, you know, for example, Netflix, if I have a good month where I'm not working too much and I actually watch Ozarks and, you know, several other shows and movies, it makes me wonder if, you know, on a monetary basis, it's so much cheaper for me. I don't have any other, I have Amazon Prime, but those are the only two that I have. And I'm like you, like I'm a huge baseball fan and there's a team, I won't mention them, but I would love to follow them, but I don't want to pay to watch them. So I have to draw the line somewhere as well.
I think it's instructive maybe that Amazon's most common price point on their rental service is also $3, unlike the callers. Ticket price to the second run movie, right? I mean, that's probably a good price point for that kind of thing. I think, you know, the second run theaters are fantastic. They're definitely, you know, less prevalent than they used to be. But they were so important to me growing up. Grew up in a small Washington State town that had a second-run theater nearby, and same deal, right? $2, you know, $1 on the weekends, and you could, you know, if you're a kid, you know, completely find or scrape together that money, and it was a way to see these films. Otherwise, it would have had no chance.
Yeah, in high school, I mean, I was in a fairly populated area with plenty of first-run theaters, but in high school, every Friday, we'd get out of school and go to the Dollar Theater. That was what we did.
Yeah.
See what was going playing.
Well, in the time we have left, let's go for our pick three.
Okay. Well, you already said one of mine, Ozark, with Jason Bateman on Netflix. I'm not done with it yet, but I'm going through it right now. Really interesting to see him in a dramatic role. I've always been a big Jason Bateman fan, especially with Arrested Development.
Mm-hmm.
So it's fun to see him in something really different. Another Netflix series, we've been talking about Netflix, Glow, which is another, neither of these series are really family friendly, so don't watch them with your family, but Glow is the very much dramatized story of the gorgeous ladies of wrestling from the 80s, that series. So it's really interesting, funny, but also heartbreaking at times. And then an oddball one, I want to recommend a Vanity Fair story. The story of the DuckTales theme, history's catchiest single minute of music, a woohoo heard around the world, by Darren King. Disney is rebooting DuckTales. They're keeping the good theme song, although a new performance of it. And that's a fun little article about how that was written.
Interesting.
All right. So we didn't get a chance to coordinate. So Andrew poached one of mine. I would also second Glow because I also watched that. I really enjoyed that. So two quick, I guess, films that are in theaters right now in the Valley. The Big Sick, which is a really delightful kind of cross-cultural comedy of the comedian Kumail Nanjiani and how he met his wife, Emily Gordon. Also, Al Gore's follow-up to An Inconvenient Truth. It's called An Inconvenient Sequel, which is a great kind of bringing us up to date on the the status of the world's response to climate change. And it's actually a pretty optimistic story, although the final beats with the incoming administration is a little bit of a downer. But Al Gore remains optimistic. And so I guess I'll do an oddball here to fill in my third. Is a pretty strange network series on NBC called Midnight Texas, which is sort of campy, quite silly story about a one stoplight town in Texas that is, for some reason, filled with demons and other supernatural creatures. And this guy who rolls into town clearly has a complex future here. It's only three episodes in. It was a summer replacement series, or we used to call it a replacement series. But it's kind of fun, and my teens like it. So
I don't know if Jeffrey ever contributes three for his, but I have.
Go for it.
I have maybe two. One is Ozark again. I was thinking when I watched the first episode, I thought, oh, I hope this isn't just a knockoff of Breaking Bad. And I think it's quirky enough that it stands on its own. I enjoyed it. I recently read a book, and I apologize because I didn't plan on actually contributing to these, but Everybody Lies. And it's, I wish I could remember the author, but it's about big data and how we all lie when people, you know, call us on the phone and ask us our political opinion or ask us about our sex life. And by going to Google searches, you can find out this wealth of information about how everybody lies. And it's just really fascinating how the data is being used by both big corporations and individuals to learn. There are websites that have been created that their purpose is for obscure diseases. People can post their symptoms and find out, you know, it's sort of crowdsourcing the old medical school question and making sure that you're getting some good information on all that. But
the author is Seth Stevens Davidowitz.
That's right. Thank you very much. Yeah. But I just finished that book and I thoroughly enjoyed it. So anyway, this has been Signal and Noise today, and this is a regular feature with a couple of professors from Southern Oregon University. We had Andrew Gay with us and Chris Lucas, an instructor there today.